It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Larry Mantle. Earlier on Film Week, our critics reviewed the new Netflix film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven. It's written and directed by Oscar winner Aaron Sorkin, a historical drama based on the trial of seven who were charged with crimes stemming from the 1968 Democratic National Convention protests in Chicago. Sorkin's probably best known for writing movies like The Social Network, Moneyball, and A Few Good Men. He also created the hit TV political drama The West Wing. But he ventured into directing for the first time with his 2017 Oscar-nominated film Molly's Game. Recently, he sat down with KPCC's John Horn, and Sorkin said the first draft of Chicago 7 dates back to 2007, and John asked him why the film took more than a decade to finally make it to the big screen.
There was a series of events that began with the writer's strike, which I think it started the day after I delivered that first draft of the script. But I would say that the common denominator in why the movie was having trouble getting made was the riots. It was just hard to see how you could fit this movie inside of a budget that was in proportion to what the studio felt the audience appetite for the film was going to be. When it was finally my turn to direct it, after Steven and after Paul Greengrass and Ben Stiller and a few others, it was just, hey, here's the money you have to make the movie with. You figure out how to do the riots. And so often I've found some kind of production necessity, like the budget, forces you to get creative. And you end up making a choice that's what you would have done if you'd had an unlimited budget. It's the Jaws theory, right? That the shark never worked. Steven always had to figure out a way to shoot around the shark every day. And as a result, we don't see the shark until the end of the second act, which is exactly when we should be seeing the shark.
By using archival footage, it places the story in a reality that wouldn't exist if you were restaging that.
That's right. And one of the things that allowed us to do that was being able to shoot in Chicago, being able to shoot in Grant Park, where the riots actually took place, and then spilling out onto Michigan Avenue. Because we were shooting in Grant Park, which hasn't changed at all since 1968, looks exactly the same, we were able to combine our original footage, the stuff that we were shooting, with news footage, stock footage, archival footage, never trying to pretend that stuff was ours. We desaturated the color in those so that's black and white. But that, as you said, it is one of the things that helps build a bridge between 1968 and 2020. So in every way, we tried to do that, whether it was not leaning into 60s iconography, not using a 60s score. We used an original film score, plainly written today, by Daniel Pemberton. And then the rest of it, listen, we thought the film was plenty relevant when we were making it. We didn't need it to get more relevant. But then, obviously, in the last few months, with clashes between protesters and police that included tear gas and nightsticks, it sure felt like we were right back in 68.
No, the archival footage becomes modern day.
That's right. Looking at CNN's coverage of the protests in Minneapolis and Kenosha, I felt like, you know, God, if you just degraded that, the color a little bit, it would look exactly like what we're using. So back to, because I want to give credit where it's due, which is in this case is the Faden Papamichael, our cinematographer. We got some wide shots, the wide shots that we were going to need, and we were helped there by, I hate to be glib about this, but by the tear gas. Because there was so much smoke, we could make 100 or so protesters look like thousands. Other than those wide shots, it was mostly very tight shots that we were using, you know, just somebody's eyes right before it got cracked, right before they were cracked across the face with a nightstick. A tear gas canister being loaded in and fired. And the mixture of the tight shots, our wide shots, and the archival footage in the hands of Faden, our DP, Alan, our editor, made, as I said, what I think we would have ended up doing if we'd had an unlimited budget.
I want to play a clip from not a movie, but from something that happened in 2016. And I think a lot of people, including you, might remember when it happened.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Look, see, he's smiling. See, he's having a good time. I love the old days, you know? You know what I hate? There's a guy totally disruptive, throwing punches. We're not allowed to punch back anymore. I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks. That's true. You know, I love our police, and I really respect our police, and they're not getting enough. They're not. But honestly, I hate to see that. Here's a guy throwing punches, nasty as hell, screaming and everything else when we're talking. And he's walking out, and we're not allowed, you know, the guards are very gentle with him. He's walking out like big high fives, smiling, laughing, like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
This is obviously well before the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, but it's about protesting and it's about authoritarianism and the right to protest and not be beaten up. What did that moment mean to this project? And did it help you really feel an even greater urgency to get this story told?
That moment right there that you just played got the movie made. That was the moment that where Stephen, you know, back in 2006, 14 years ago, the last thing Stephen said to me before I left his house was, it would be great if this movie could come out before the election. Trump getting nostalgic about the good old days when we used to beat the crap out of them and carry them out of here on a stretcher. He's talking about protesters. I think lit a new fire under Stephen. That what you just played there, that wasn't a one-off, by the way. That's part of his greatest hits. And that's why I say that we thought that the film was relevant while we were making it, that we didn't need this extra relevancy to come along for scenes from Chicago 7 to be played out, to be performed all over America with Trump in the role of Mayor Daley. Seeing that, listen, even divorced from Chicago 7, seeing that from a presidential candidate and now from a president is disheartening. But while on the one hand, I should thank Donald Trump for giving us that last push that got the movie made, I think he should go to hell anyway.
The trial transcript itself is 22,000 pages. The abridgment, which is published as a book called The Conspiracy Trial, runs 600 pages.
That's right. The short version is 600 pages.
At what point is that a blessing? At what point is that a curse?
Well, there's a lot of material, to be sure. At first, it feels like a curse because you feel like there's too much here. How can I possibly dramatize all of this? How can I do any of it a service? How can I make any of it good if I'm trying to do all of it? Then you finally get to the place where it feels okay to not do all of it. It's, you know, it's the old thing of Michelangelo and David. I put a hunk of marble up there and I chopped away everything that wasn't David. Or in my case, I get through a first draft. I get to the end. That first draft could be 200 or 300 pages long, twice as long as a screenplay is supposed to be, really. But by the time I get to the end, I have figured out what it is and isn't about. So I can start cutting away the things that don't serve the story we're telling and start hanging small lanterns on the things that do.
KPCC's John Horn in conversation with writer-director Aaron Sorkin about his new film, The Trial of the Chicago 7. It's out now in select theaters that have reopened. It's also streaming on Netflix for subscribers. More of John's interview with Aaron Sorkin just ahead on Film Week. We'll be back in 1 minute. to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Let's get back to that interview, KPCC's John Horn with writer-director Aaron Sorkin about Sorkin's new film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven.
Studio executives have been known to say, no one would ever believe that. Take it out of the script. But in reading the transcript, I was looking over it, and specifically comments made by U.S. District Court Judge Julius Hoffman. Did you ever say to yourself, essentially, were it not there on the page, I wouldn't put this in the script because no one would buy it?
Yeah, almost all of it in this case. If this were fiction, no one would buy it. No one would like it. It would just be too crazy. We wouldn't think that that could ever happen in a courtroom. As I say, it's a painting and not a photograph, but I wouldn't make the trial crazier than it was. I wouldn't add circus to it. The trial was actually more circus-like than even the circus that you see in the movie.
But to my mind, there are three central stories that you've decided to focus on. One is the trial itself. Another is the sometimes fractious relationship between Tom Hayden and Abbie Hoffman. And the third is tracking the escalation of the protests, which start peacefully and end up violently. So when you're thinking about, and maybe I'm missing another, but those three central stories, what prompted that choice and what prompted the way that you are putting them together, sometimes chronologically and sometimes not, to make the story go forward at all times?
Well, you're right that that is how ultimately the story organized itself for me, or how I organized the story into those. We would be telling all three stories at the same time. But yes, the courtroom drama, the evolution of the riot, how did what was supposed to be a peaceful protest evolve into such a violent clash with the police and the National Guard, and then the more personal story between Abbie and Tom. It's that last one, the personal story between Abbie and Tom, that somehow kind of makes the other two a sing. It makes the whole thing accessible. It doesn't become just about a conflict of ideas. It's about these people. These two people, and I never would have been able to get to that story by just reading the 22,000 page transcript, by just reading the dozen or so good books that have been written about it. I only would have gotten that to that story by spending time with Hayden, which I was able to do when I first started working on this. He passed away about 4 years ago.
I want to play a quick scene, and this is between Abbie Hoffman, who's played by Sacha Baron Cohen, and Assistant U.S. Attorney Richard Schultz, who's played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
You have contempt for your government.
I'll tell you, Mr. Schultz, it's nothing compared to the contempt my government has for me.
We've heard testimony from 27 witnesses under oath that say you hoped for a confrontation with the police, that your plans for the convention were designed specifically to draw the police into a confrontation.
Well, if I'd known it was going to be the first wish of mine that came true, I would have aimed a lot higher.
It's a yes or no question. When you came to Chicago, were you hoping for a confrontation with the police? I'm concerned you have to think about it.
Give me a moment, would you, friend? I've never been on trial for my thoughts before.
So this is a scene that was written and filmed well before the authorities in the United States started beating up peaceful protesters, and well before Attorney General William Barr suggested that people who commit crimes during protests be charged with sedition, the overthrow of the country. So yeah. How do you feel as the last few months have unfolded and what you were writing years and years ago have come into sharper focus, that this not period movie has become contemporary?
Well, I'm as shocked and chilled as everyone else. I mean, as far as the film goes, the 14 years was plainly worth the wait. I feel like we've kind of now been on this 14-year collision course with history, but we've seen over the last 4 years the demonization of protest. Obviously, it's gone into hyperdrive in the last few months. The law that the Chicago Seven were charged with, which is conspiracy to cross state lines in order to incite a riot, was a law nobody had ever been charged with before, and no one has ever been charged with since. But even before the protests in Minneapolis, Kenosha, Madison, Lexington, D.C., even before that, with athletes kneeling during the national anthem. Those people being demonized as un-American. And remember that in most, not all, but in most cases, these athletes are Black. And they're also being told that they're ungrateful, that they get to earn a lot of money playing a game. And it's just got this whiff of why isn't anyone saying thank you to the white people for allowing you to live your lives? And we're right back in 1968 with America, Love It or Leave It. In fact, I saw a still photograph of people holding signs outside the courthouse. And there were as many people who hated the Chicago Seven as who were cheering them on. And three signs caught my eye. One of them was America, Love It or Leave It. I saw a sign that said, what about white civil rights? And incredibly, I saw a sign that said, lock them up. So I said to our prop master, I want these three signs. Whatever else you do, I want these three signs. And I told Faden, push in hard on those signs. When I get to the edit, I'll decide if it's too heavy-handed or not, but I want that.
Right after the 2016 presidential election, we were talking with the singer-songwriter Tori Amos, and I asked her about the election, and she said, I'm sharpening my pencil. Which,
good.
I love that line. If good. You are sharpening your pencil right now, what is it writing down? What are your priorities, and how might they have changed?
It's tougher for me than for Tori, and not just because she's significantly more talented than I am. First of all, bad times tend to produce good art, right? This particular bad time, the star of it, I predict Gleason's performance on the Comey rule notwithstanding, because I thought they did that well. I predict that you're going to see a lot written about these 4 years, but that you will hardly ever see Trump as anything but an off-screen character. You'll see him on the news. On the TV. And the reason why is he's implausible. Like the trial, in the trial of Chicago 7, you just don't believe it. Listen, you can write a protagonist and an antagonist and an anti-hero and a villain, but you cannot write a character who doesn't have a conscience, who doesn't have a soul. Richard III is a bad guy, but he's A, brilliant, and B, you get what is motivating him, okay? There's something there that you can connect with. I like to say if I'm writing an anti-hero that, like Mike Nicholson and a few big men, you have to write them as if they're making their case to God why they should be allowed into heaven. You can't make Trump's case for him.
Aaron, thank you so much, and congratulations on the great movie.
Appreciate it.
KPECC's John Horn talking with Aaron Sorkin, the writer and director of the new film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven. John spoke with Sorkin on the occasion of Sorkin winning the 2020 Screenwriter Award at this year's Middleburg Film Festival in Virginia. John's there for the weekend. You can stream the film on Netflix if you're a subscriber. It can also be seen in select theaters that have reopened. Check your local listings. Thank you so much for joining us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Have a great weekend.